Hi, friend. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. Brussels to Massachusetts.
Yes, that's right.
All the fancy buildings and the good beer.
And the Atlantic Ocean between us.
That's true. I think you got the better end of the weather,
Yeah,
though.
it's pretty nice here now. So,
I had a very good time. I recently went to Boston and I was just amazed. We went to Cambridge and with Interintellect, we toured MIT and Harvard and did a dinner there. And I was just, it's char like, I don't know why, but like, I just found Boston absolutely charming and historic. And the food was amazing and people were super nice. So you have a good neck of the woods.
That's sweet. Yeah, I'm fond of it, of course, having grown up around here. So, yes, well, I'd love to start by asking you the question I ask everybody, which is to tell me about your life story and your background, and you can answer that in any way that you want, at whatever length you'd like.
Wow, starting with the easy
The
question.
easy question, totally easy,
What
no
are you doing on
pressure.
Earth? Hi, I'm Anna. I'm the founder and CEO of Interintellect. We are an online community and a curated marketplace for events for artists and intellectuals. We deeply believe in peaceful encounters and cultural abundance. So we're trying to build a profitable culture street on the internet, where everybody from anywhere in the world, in their pajamas, from their couch, can tap into the amazing creativity, ideas, civic discourse, and initiative that are happening all over us, all over the world, and all around us. And I've been building this for altogether almost 6 years, but in the current form, 2.5 years. My background, so I'm originally Hungarian. I grew up in Budapest, which is the capital of Hungary. It's a very nice Central Eastern European city with a lot of 19th century and early 20th century buildings and art. It's not very good for political freedoms, if you heard about that, or just being free in general. But when I was a child, communism has just ended, and there was a moment of respite when it looked like there is some hope. So there was a process for me when I just tried to make it work in Budapest, and I wanted to be a writer. I kind of succeeded, so that's good. I was working. I have a book of poetry that was published when I was 19. I published frequently in literary magazines. I worked on screenplays, plays, short stories, books, a lot of things. I was a journalist, and then gradually I went into more kind of hyper and organizational things because I just have a lot of energy. I started working in music. I managed a couple of rock bands in my 20s, wrote a lot of lyrics, wrote for a music magazine. I worked a little bit in production for films as well. Started a feminist platform, one of the first popular feminist platforms in Hungary that was very, very successful in 2013. And it took me a while to kind of find the right way in which I can kind of do my best, combining my artistic interests and this managerial talent that I have. And through many, many iterations and explorations, failure, 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 failure for a very long time, and being thought I was crazy by other people, this thing kind of came out of the mold and presented itself to me, basically built by the people who wanted to use it, and us kind of running after them and building software and processes around what they have already been doing, which is always what I envisioned to do. I had a couple of, when I worked in startups, I dreaded the conversation where like UX designers sit down and say, at this point, we want the user to do this. I always thought, the user knows exactly what they want to do. Like, your job is to get out of the way. And so I think we haven't really got there yet with the product, but with like the experience that Interintellect provides, I think it's very obvious when you're there that this is being created real time by the people who participate. So I'm very happy with that. And it's really the combination of irreconcilable interests and skills and directions into something that is surprisingly coherent. And I think that's why people feel so liberated with their own irreconcilable interests and multidisciplinary things and bipartisan thoughts in our midst. So, you know, the form and the content are always the same, and it's the same here.
Thank you for sharing that. I'd be curious to ask you about sort of your intellectual history and like who some of the thinkers are that have really inspired you over the years.
There are so many. Mm-hmm. I think the first people that inspired me were the great novelists. When I was a teenager, I read novels by the dozen. I was just obsessed, and I would read something like 8 times. I remember reading 100 Years of Solitude just over and over again, the same text, until I almost memorized the whole thing. I loved biographies. I loved explorers. I loved history. I read a lot of biographies of artists. Paul Gauguin was my favorite, and I would read everything I could about him. I loved movies. I was deeply inspired by great filmmakers as great examples of people combining artistic sensitivity and the badassness needed for governing a bunch of people to create something amazing, like captains of ships. I had, you know, Ingmar Bergman phase and the Martin Scorsese phase and all those phases, Antonioni and Luis Buñuel. And even though I did not end up as a film director, which is a whole different story, I often feel that I did take something away from them. And who else? I'm thinking, I think pilgrims, people who went, the first Europeans who went to India and China and studied the languages there or the music, people following their minds through enormous obstacles, social, financial, or actual mountains in some cases, I found really, really inspiring. But I think when I was young, I was more looking for a real life mentor to be my role model, but it has been one of the tragedies of my life that I never found, like I have amazing mentors in my life who are a little bit more like friends or like advisors, or professional advisors, but I never had that kind of master, you know, that you sit next to by the cave and you are enlightened. Maybe I didn't need one. Maybe it's a good thing. When I actually meet somebody who has met a person like this, it's like highly suspicious to me in every way, or exploitative. But I remember watching Kill Bill when it came out, and there are the scenes in the second part. It's the second part, yeah? When she comes out of the grave and goes to... No, it's the second part when she has the Paimon's cruel tutelage. Mm. Reminded me of this youthful folly of mine that I wanted to have that kind of person in my life. I never got it, but who knows? Maybe one day. No, I would probably like tell them to bugger off. I would revolt against them.
You said that you've been working on Intrintellect in some shape or form for about 6 years, and then just in this current form for about 2.5 years. But what was sort of the 4 years before this current iteration?
So the first kind of instinct that I had about this came about in October 2016. And it was a moment in my private life and in the historical situation and a lot of other things when I felt that, you know, that idea that I had had about my life, which was that I would be very meta and I would just write and teach at the university and use the world and analyze it and write about it, was no longer tenable. And that there was this battle cry, and everybody has to like drop whatever they're doing. Cincinnatus has to leave the plow, and now it's the time to get involved. But I had no idea how I could contribute. I was in a very bad moment in my own life and had zero confidence, zero money, and absolutely zero network. So I had to like think very first principles, like, okay, what do I know? What is on my CV? And kind of from pieces, I started figuring out what is something where I could be really useful, where my knowledge would be applicable, and what would actually give me a lot of enjoyment. It was almost like this ikigai style meditation that I had to be really honest to myself that, you know, if I have to get involved, like if we posit that I have to get involved, how would I get involved if I was looking at myself from the outside? Like, what would I do? And I basically just did what popped up there in the middle. So that would be culture, language, discourse, and something where those things can be, you know, like a space where people can meet and reconcile their differences. But it went through various very, very big iterations. Or pivots, let's say. The first thing that I wanted to do, and this says more about my like types of experiences I had until then. So the first thing I started doing was more like a think tank, more like something where people can do adversarial research. So we would have brought together two thinkers who really disagree about something and like have them write something together until they agree on at least one thing. And then we did it once, and I knew that it was impossible to, like, it takes half a year to just get one in. And then you're not paying, you know, it's like a whole thing. And I also, you know, at the time I started learning about more academically, kind of influenced or based organizations that have a far better access to these thinkers, much better methodology, the funding for it. And I think one of the things that you always have to keep in mind is what are you one of the best in the world at? Like top, is there something in the world where you're like in the top 25, one, whatever percent? And in that idea, I had to be really honest to myself that I'm not the best person to do this. And I think that's really important to then be and say, okay, if I'm a startup and in the first maybe a couple of years, I am the sole driver of this because nobody will take it seriously, nobody will use it yet, then you have to really do something that you can do with your eyes closed, I think, in the kitchen. And so with a couple of people that I met whilst workshopping this idea, and I was literally running around London. I wasn't really on Twitter at the time. I was running out of London and just telling every engineer, kind of socially conscious researcher, EA person about this. And then from these conversations arose the first pivot. And actually I worked on this for 1.5 years, was first called ICSI, which is the formula for mutual information in Shannon, IXY. And then we tried to build this kind of chatbot called ICSI. This was the chatbot era. So like 2017, that would grasp kind of emerging conflicts in chatting and would give you tools to not get into a fight. This was kind of like early days of deep polarization, where a lot of it was still playing out in people's personal conversations. Right now it doesn't anymore, right? Because the polarization in the US and the UK is relatively complete. So you no longer even talk to people with whom you would politically disagree, which is kind of tragic. And it was a really interesting also, it was a very kind of intellectually educational moment for me because I was doing a lot of proprietary research. So I realized very early on that there's not many papers on this. So I was just like running around London campuses and interviewing thousands of people whilst working at night as a financial night editor, looking at like news from 10:30 p.m. to 6:30 a.m., sleeping a few hours and then getting back to it. And then I was talking to people at like big universities, like Princeton, I don't know, like, you know, really cool places. And they had no idea about this, or they would have the exact opposite opinion. And I was like, dude, I'm telling you this, like I'm sitting here in London. I have spoken to all these people. these are the results. These are the problems that people have. And they would be like, no, because in this paper in 2013, and I'm like, yeah, but in 2013, these apps didn't exist yet. So like, just hear me out. And then I kind of like, I think that was the moment when I thought, okay, my project is not going to be very academic, because like the speed at which things are changing and how agile you have to be, how humble, how hands-on, go to people, talk to them physically or on Zoom. You know, it's like the methodology is very, very different. To my great pleasure, actually, after or at the time when I was pivoting from this, and I will tell you how that happened, another company called May, so MEI, in New York, built an app, which was a chat app layer, I think, that you could put on text, I think, or Messenger, that did this. And they had some success with it. I don't know if they still exist, but you know, it was a really beautiful kind of, you know, like it's kind of rewarding your efforts that there's somebody else doing it as well and that it goes on. And for me, I started having inklings when I got more active on Twitter that things are not as bad as you think. I had this conversation with Becky McCormick yesterday because she wrote this beautiful essay about how, you know, there's no way out of tribalism. And I think there's a layer when it's bad, but like at the core, it's still beautiful and human, and we're the same and we're friends. The kind of goal is to let that level come to the front, right? We have all these different levels. And so toward the end of 2018, I was like super active on Twitter. I was much more, not partisan political, but I was like first principle political much more than I am now. And I had all these amazing experiences. And then I went to San Francisco and started doing these Twitter reunions, basically. And I had this epiphany that, you know, things are much better. I don't have to build this self-protective tool for people. I don't even believe in it anymore. What we need is just create spaces with good rules where the encounter and the cultural experience or the intellectual artistic experience can naturally arise. And then really good things will happen. And that has been true in Interintellect. I mean, we've done over 1,500 events. We had zero incidents. We have people getting married in Interintellect and writing books and moving in together with each other and moving across continents for each other. And so I've been kind of justified in this assumption. It took me a long time. And so after San Francisco, I basically just like stopped working on the app and started figuring out like, okay, I'm building a space. What the hell does that mean? You know? And you encounter all these similar projects that are just kind of bogus, you know, and you try to convince people that, yeah, but we're not bogus. And I think it's like every startup's problem. Like you're facing people's priors of like the worst versions of you, you know? And then I started going back very strongly to my show business experiences and music production and film production, theater, and basically built Interintellect like experience on my knowledge of like how to run. We're basically running this distributed theater space on the internet around the world where people come together for a variety of different cultural purposes, talks, discussions, readings, you know, workshops, and like my knowledge from how to produce that has proved to be very useful.
Mm-hmm. Is it correct that you received an Emergent Ventures grant to help Interintellect get started?
Yeah, so that was the first three checks that actually enabled me to leave London, which is very important in this journey because I'm not in any way rich and I would not have been able to afford living in London for any longer and build something with this amount of dedication. Like all day long, every day of the week, I work on Interintellect, right? And I don't have to work on anything else. And that's amazing. So I had a small angel check from Nat Friedman, who was at the time the CEO of GitHub. I got a very small Emergent Ventures grant, which at the time still felt like a lot of money to me. again, I was living in London and like you get a dollar grant, but when you look at it in pounds, you know, so it's very like London is not a good place for like making a lot out of your money. And then I got, we got into Bloomberg Beta's Beacon program, which I don't know if it still exists. And so that was the initial funding with which I could move to Brussels. Sorry, I talk too much.
No problem.
Sorry, I was too fast. So we got into Bloomberg Beta's Beacon program, which was super, like for super early stage companies, really just when you have ideas and a couple of people think that you're okay. That was super, that was amazing. And so I basically started 2020 with a little money in the bank. That was completely new for me. And I was very happy for 5 minutes. And then I got COVID. I was an early adopter in COVID. I got very serious near-death experience COVID. And once I had it, I couldn't speak for 3 weeks. And so I started the online community for Intrainsalect. Whilst having a thermometer in my mouth.
Oh gosh. But was it going to be just in person before that? Or that's just like when you happened to start the online community?
I didn't really know at the time, to be honest. I was kind of opposed to building an online community because I had been part of a bunch and they all just died out after a couple of weeks. And I was like, I like books and conversations. I don't know if I would have the energy to run an online community. And then I suddenly, again, kind of like changed my vantage point on the problem and started looking at it as something that happens between events. And suddenly it started making sense to me. And I understood that it would come from the same energy source as my event and discussion work. And then I just did it.
What do you think contributes to online communities dying? And what do you think has helped the Intrainsalect to grow in spite of that tendency?
Like every project, they die when the leader gives up. So I think, you know, if you're listening to this and you're wondering whether you should start an online community, I think that's a lot of people actually these days. Think about your own, think about what you're looking for and what would make you stop wanting that thing. I think like one of the dark sides of really downsides of online community is both from the leadership perspective and the user's perspective, and this is not discussed enough, is people have confusing expectations of them, right? People who start online communities sometimes do it because they don't have a good enough social life for their standards. And then they think, oh, let's just like dump these people into a tag, you know, signal group or wherever they are. And then I will no longer be sad. And then, you know, when the people are there, you realize like they are humans and they do all sorts of things. Some of those things make you happy and some make you sad. So if your purpose is to have zero sadness in a room where there are a lot of people with a super diverse set of personal experiences, then that's not going to work. Other people do communities to sell them things, right? And that's like, I go into a community because I think it's something, and then it turns out to be something completely different, and this dude is trying to sell me stuff. That's a no. So that might be also. And then, you know, you as the founder or the community, you are disappointed because you're nobody wants to buy your shoes or whatever. There are communities that are trying to look for a certain kind of person, and then they face the complexity of the human character very early on when they actually meet the real people. Communities that are just badly advertised. Somebody has a really good but very niche idea, and they think, oh, you know, I love early Bronze Age axes. And this should be a place where we celebrate the new archaeological findings of different weaponry. But you don't actually tell the people who like that those things, then you will have zero people, right? Like, but those people are somewhere. So, you know, you can find them. But if you don't, you know, put that work in, then that's not going to happen. So I think if you have, if you understand that online communities will bring you the same kind of enjoyment that having a bunch of friends and some strangers in your living room and you like talk about everything and nothing and then everybody goes home and this was great, then it's going to work for you. Because you're never like, oh, I hosted this thing in my living room and I will never host it again. You're like, I'm going to like take a rest and sleep and then I will invite them other people again next week, right? And so, yeah, I think this very self-governance with online communities is really, really important. And also to understand that people come and go, and if you're an online community, your job is to be this stable point in the lives of a lot of people who don't have, we don't have many stable like things in our lives, right? And so like my experience having been doing this for 2 years is this cyclicality of people coming and going and falling in love and writing things and discovering talents and then going away and then coming back. And you just have to have the emotional stability of trusting the process, trusting them, and just allowing humans to be humans. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
No problem. when you're running a salon yourself, what makes for a good salon in your experience?
Oh, that's such a good question. I did a host training yesterday. That's why I don't have a voice. So I sound like cool Welsh singer, which I'm not. I'm doing like, I'm losing my voice. Should I record an album? So that's such an interesting thing. Okay. It really depends on the topic. So you want different conversations, or you think that there are, every topic has like 5-10 different good ways to discuss them. And you want one of those to happen. I have favorites. I love it when, like, some hosts don't like it. I love it when the attendees take over, when there's like a natural conversation that arises and people just get into this amazing conversation and then you're just like there and like, oh my God, this is amazing. But if you're, you know, if you're running an artistic workshop or a writing session on Interintellect, then, you know, you will like, maybe your, what you will be looking for would be, you know, beautiful writings being produced during your event. If you're doing a meditation type of thing, or a very deep kind of self-exploratory salon, then you would like to see that this was really fulfilling to your attendees and they are happy at the end, or they leave happier than how they came, you know? And yeah, to me, salons are a celebration of humans, and I'm there and just these random strangers coming from the internet and they share amazing stories, prove incredible talents, have wit, overcome shyness, come up with a new thought on the spot. So, you know, it's my privilege really to be able to be present in those moments at such a scale. It's even more intense, I think, when I'm attending at a salon of, that somebody else is hosting, because then I don't have the responsibility to, you know, look after everybody's experience. But there's also beauty to being the responsible adult in the room and just like giving this ease to everybody else. I think hosting salons is probably one of the most like fulfilling and significant experiences I've ever had in my life. And I do it all the time. So this is like something that replicates like every time. It's a kind of an artistic experience. So maybe a dancer performing the same thing a lot, a musician would get this recurring magic, let's call it that way.
How do you experience that? Like, what is that like for you when you get that deep fulfillment from being in or running a salon?
Sometimes I cry if it's a very moving thing. It's a kind of a beautiful artistic slash transcendental feeling of being there and knowing that this magic has happened. I think it's really only possible in live environments, because when it's live, that it's by nature a collaboration. Because the conversation is being created together in an ongoing way. If only one person is talking, it's not a conversation. So you have to have these people collaborating on making it happen. And then it's, and sometimes it happens, and then like sometimes the magic happens, which is probably like a smaller subset, but it's still relatively frequent. And that's really, really beautiful. It's very common at Interintellect events to have like magic in one person. Or two people speak and they both bring in some magic from their life. But this kind of collective magic is relatively rare. When it happens, you just remember and it's beautiful.
Are there any specific memories you could share of a time that that happened?
There's this example that I sometimes bring up. We did a salon on Road to Damascus moments. When people, had really strongly changed their minds about something, or left a religion, fell out of love, or fell in love, converted to religion, big life-changing moments and realizations. And it was a really highly attended salon. This was during the pandemic when, people were becoming to like three Interintellect salons sometimes a day. I mean, it was like we only had like 20 users, but they came all the time and we were worried about them, like, go to the toilet, get a sandwich, open the window. Is this healthy? And so I have a lot of people there. And when you have a lot of people in your salon, that's a different kind of responsibility, because your responsibility is almost chronological. You have to ensure that everybody gets their own time, and feels heard and listened to. And so, yeah, we just went around the room and everybody shared their big Road to Damascus moment. We had people with stories of coming out to their family. We had people leaving Mormonism and returning to it on their own terms. People realizing that they don't want to be the type of person that they always thought they would want, like really cathartic moments, a lot of crying, but very beautiful sharing of, these experiences that people felt and had felt until that then, that they were alone with this experience. And then you have 40 other people, some of you whom you already know, and it turns out that so many people have it. And then after like 2 hours, when you really thought that, we've maxed this out, like this is already magic. And then this guy, a good friend of mine, this guy goes, and he's like, so I was on the road to Damascus in the war as in the American Army. And then he tells you this big story, and everybody's just like, we raised our hands and we're like, an angel is passing. Like this room is full of grace, and this is the most beautiful thing ever. And this is something that I often think about, as a really, really beautiful example of what can be done in the right space, even on a Zoom call. Another thing, for a different reason that I remember, and it's beautiful. We do play readings for fun with the hosts. We did Uncle Vanya and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and we did one of my two favorite plays, Arcadia by Tom Stoppard, which is hilarious but a very difficult text with like literary research and really high level mathematics, and half of it is set in like early 18th century, or no, early 19th century, sorry. And so we have a room full of hosts with like really big roles already handed out. And it's like you self-cast in an Excel sheet, so people chose their own roles. But all of them were cold reading this super difficult text. and they nailed it. They were so good. I laughed my head off. I have a video of this. It was amazing. I was just sitting there, you know, with this favorite play that I almost know by heart, all of it. And just listen to these hosts who became hosts like 2 months prior, or some of them, you know, and just this talent and sense of humor and confidence. It was amazing. And how they also like found their voices throughout the reading. So toward the end, you had people having just, you know, these faces of just realizing that, oh my God, I'm really good at this. So that's amazing. And it's just such an honor to be there.
I want to ask the same sort of question, but from a different angle of like, and part of the reason I'm curious is you know, this is a one-to-one conversation that we're having right now. And that's my like preferred mode of conversation. I love one-on-one conversations, and that's why I do this podcast. And I tend to not like group conversations as much in general, with some exceptions, but, and I, you know, clearly that's not, I'm imagining that's not the case for you because, you know, you seem to really thrive on them. And I wonder, yeah, I'm just trying to dig into that a little bit. And I wonder, you know, I know from your Twitter feed that you like often when you go to cities, you'll like go to dinner with people or like things like that. Like you meet up with Interintellect people and like presumably have lots of group conversations outside of salons as well. And I'm wondering, sort of the same question, but from that angle of like, what do you think makes for a really good group conversation? Like, you know, just in a normal setting outside of a salon.
I think that the five rules of hosting and the four rules of get for the five rules, I always mix up the five rules of gathering and the four rules of hosting that we have as main principles can be applied on any conversation. So they include the conversation not really having a goal or a purpose beyond itself, right? So there's no hidden agenda. Nobody's trying to convert you. Nobody's trying to sell you anything. Nobody's campaigning for a party here. What it is set to be about is what it is about. Some entail needing to come up with something. There is a question in the title, or there's something to be written or tried during the event. Yes, but like you're not going to be surprised. So one thing is to have a really easy and clear idea in everybody's head about what this is about. It would entail access. So, you know, it is conducted in a manner and with a vocabulary that is accessible to the greatest amount of people. You know, a lot of conversations kind of become driven by a couple of alphas who show off to each other and start using words that are only used in certain industries. And then everybody else feels embarrassed to say anything. And then they just like nod. And then the people talking think like, oh, I'm so interesting that they are all listening to me. And they're like, no, they're like in deep suffering right now and they can't wait to go home. They're just too polite to say anything. This entails, I think, openness. Like we experience openness in the sense that most of our events are public. So you don't have to have met anybody yet or know the host. You can just like buy a ticket and come in. This is really important to me personally. I think that culture and knowledge should be fully democratic and out there. And you know, the more you contribute, the more you're rewarded. And I really want to be the place where you can learn about Aristotle for 10 bucks. You know, you're still putting down some money to show that you value this thing and so that the host makes money, but you don't have to be 1% to, you know, engage in something that is for free available in a public library. Like, why should you pay, you know, $40,000 a year to have a chance to discuss something that you can read for free? It makes no sense. Anyway, so, you know, when something doesn't make sense for me, I build it in the way that I think it makes sense. In terms of like my hosting, my general like hosting, I really believe in hosts. And I think that when I researched dialogue you know, I studied how to write dialogue when I was a screenwriter and a playwright. And then I researched the linguistics of dialogue when I was working on the self-protective version of the company that was the app thing, and conflict. And there is some theory that one-on-one conversation is in fact quite unnatural. And it's very, very common for like human disagreements to devolve into a triangle, because you need a third person. It's really hard for A against B to come to an agreement alone. You need a third person who's like, cash in, chill out, my friend. It's fine. This is not what Anna meant. You know, we need that. You know, we are group creatures. And two is not really a group. You even see this in couples, like when you're in full blown hormone cloud, you want to be alone, but actually when you want to have a kind of more playful conversation, you are happy to have a friend, somebody there, and then you can like play against each other a little bit and play, right? Mm-hmm. Playing, it's good to have three people at least. But actually the etymological origin of the word tribe is also three. So the Proto-Indo-European word for three. So it means that more than two people are a group. And so we could state that there's dialogue, which is one-on-one, and then there's conversation, which is two plus M number of people. So in the Four Rules of Hosting, which is like one of the most important documents that we give to hosts, it's on the website, anybody can read it. I even did a YouTube, I'm not very good at YouTube videos, but like I tried to do a YouTube video and it's on the Internet Tech YouTube. So we have things like stickiness, which is that nobody wants to have a conversation once, right? If it's a person you don't like, you don't want to have the conversation, period. If it's a person you do like, why wouldn't you want to talk to them again? And so that's why, in my view, like Tinder dates are a nightmare because it's a job interview. Or job interviews themselves are a nightmare. And so, you know, we make so many efforts, and there's an entire infrastructure to make it very clear at the beginning that this is a series, this is a platform. You will meet these people on the Discord. We will retweet this photo of who was there. So like, if you want to, you will always get a chance to talk to these people again. And we did this even with the offline events at the very, very beginning. Again, we would say to people, even before the first word is uttered, that, you know, if you let us share your email address with the others, then we will also share their email address with you. And so there's this buy-in. I really disliked, when I lived in London, going to all these events at the beginning as a new immigrant, intent on making friends, that I would, you know, listen and share and remember the other person and share my soul with them. And I would never see them ever again because it's a really big city and nobody ever makes an effort to create a community out of any evening's attendees. And I know that this is not me. Like we did a dinner in Zoetrope in SF in March, April 2019, sorry, with Visa. And he's going to SF and he asked me to book the same place with the same people. So we really like... You never have to feel at an Interact event that you go there and if you're in an introverted mood or, I don't know, your baby is crying next to you and you don't get a chance to like share as much there, then you will not get a chance. There's always a chance. Like this is, the chance is the state of things. You can always come back and, you know, there's always another chance. So I think, you know, communicating to a group that you bring together that there will be some kind of legacy of this is really, really important. I think there needs to be a host because people feel taken care of if there is a facilitator. If there's no facilitator, I think the darker sides of human nature are much more likely, not super likely, but more likely to emerge. There might be like a natural alpha that other people don't like. And we could, you know, it's a different experience. It's more left up to chance. I think or randomness, the better the host, the more guarantee there is and safety that this is going to be good. And so what I tell hosts is to be an imperfect host. Like a perfect host is scary. Like if you meet somebody who's like too pristine or like so trained in NVC that she's basically reading up the textbook. Then you just like close in and you're like, this is not human. So I did everything already wrong at all of my events, and they were always amazing because of that. Sit down with your people. Don't be on a TED speaker stage. Nobody wants that. So that I think is applicable.
It's a good demonstration of what you're talking about. You have a body that coughs and stuff.
Yeah, and I don't have a cold. I just hosted and participated in five events in the past 4 days, and I don't normally use my voice this much. So apologies for that.
No need to apologize.
Thank you. And so the third, yeah. So I think the imperfect host is perfectly applicable to any event. And I think what is good about what is actually comfortable about some natural hierarchies, for instance, a family dinner where your parents are in the leadership role or a work event, is that you don't have to really worry about finding your role there. You have preset roles and you can just focus on the food and the conversation. So, you know, that's an interesting, maybe an interesting note here. I don't know how I would handle that at a dinner. I think when I host a dinner, I just try to get everybody to talk to everybody and sometimes join and like move people around a little bit. I think that helps with keeping it very, very good. When it's a circle, when we're sitting around in a circle and everybody's listening to the same conversation, then you need a leader, I think. Because if you have too many shy people, then nobody will talk. But usually there are a couple of people who think, oh, this is my opportunity to become a leader. And everybody else is like, no, you know, no. So the third of the four rules of hosting that I talk about a lot is what I call the ritual space. And I bring this fully from show business, which is that create a very familiar environment. It's very hard. I tend to say it's very hard to have a dance party in a house that might fall apart. Very hard to forget yourself in a situation where the basics are uncertain. So having good lighting, good temperature, food, drinks on the table. When I host, I always just order out 3 bottles of wine, you know, and some wusa for people who don't drink, you know, try to put it in a spot that people can access. I do some research or recon beforehand. And so the kind of the bottom of the Maslow pyramid is very important here. The idea is kind of that, you know, in school you were daydreaming and in church you fall asleep, and in your favorite cafe you can finally finish the book that you can't finish at home because it's harder to concentrate. So in familiar environment, your mind is liberated and you can think and you can connect with other people. And so however much the culture is trying to tell us that everything always has to be new and la la, I think people are burnt out, and it feels really comfortable to go to your favorite theater and your favorite, you know, like cinema, your favorite store. And we try to make Interinteract into this, in a positive sense, repetitive thing, like a theater, right? Like there are all these boring practical things going on behind the singer can sing and the ballerina can dance. And I have a team who just, you know, we just do these things and build these things so that can happen. So whatever you can do at your dinner to make it feel more familiar to people, usually what people instinctively do is they try to find a person they already know, which is kind of the interpersonal equivalent of the furniture of your favorite cafe. Like you go in and you're like scanning the room and you want to go and immediately talk to somebody that you've already met. And if you're in a shy mood, you will just like stick to them. And if you're in an open mood, then you will be like the child who like leaves the mother eventually. And that's fine. So it's good if you have I sometimes have a group where nobody has met anybody yet, then it's my job as the host to find out, or I usually already arrive knowing who will come. And I'm like, oh, you do this. This other person also does this. And at least they can talk about that one thing first. They create a stronger bond and then kind of go and move away from that. And then just let people, I mean, you know, adults, they know what, children also, like humans know what they want to do, just let them do it. So I do that. And the fourth thing that we do is what I call anchoring to truth, which is just to allow people to share a lot of things about themselves first before anything was said. Because it's, first of all, you give each other topics to talk about, but also you really eliminate situations where somebody just looks at you and assumes something. So just tell who you are, why you do what you do, you know. At Intern Tech Salons, we do like online salons, we do very extensive intros. You know, in offline gatherings, we just like try to introduce people to each other and really encourage sharing. And people very happily share stories about their studies, their children, you know, why they moved to New York City or Boston or Berlin. And I just love to listen to that. So I think if you love listening to people, then you will be a very good host.
When you look back on these last few years that you've been running InterIntellect, how do you think you've had to grow personally during this time?
So three ways, like the different parts of my life all reacted differently to it. So as a startup founder, I had to basically just grow up to the task to run a company and raise money and hire people. And that was all new to me and very enjoyable to learn. And I'm very happy with our team. And so, yeah, there's that side. Personally, in my private life, I have finally become as independent as I wanted to be, or almost as independent, because there are a couple of things missing. And I really enjoy that. I'm a very independent-minded person. And so I kind of have a life now that fits it. And in terms of hosting and being with our community and our attendees, I think it completely changed my views on people. Like, I was always a little bit grumpy, Eastern European, you know, very worried about a lot of things going on the internet and in the world and in politics. And I've seen so much goodness and human amazingness and openness often coming to life in front of my face, maybe for the first time in the person's life. That I'm much more confident and stronger believer in the good internet and the good society and the power of these semi-public spaces and how they can unlock the best behavior, the best versions of ourselves in a way that is not religious, not political. Nobody's trying to sell you anything. You know, it's also not just kind of palliative care that a lot of, I think, self-help is, which is like, oh, you hate your job, so just meditate 5 minutes every morning and then you will hate it less. No, you should change your job. You know, like I think InterIntellect is more encouraging of like, just, you can do something radical. You know, like this is a self-honest space. We're not trying to just like lull you into accepting unacceptable things. So there's this honesty, but it's also a very friendly space. So I think that knowing that that's possible has really been life-changing for me.
Where do you see the project going in the coming years and decades?
I really would like us to grow more international, in the sense that we are going to start like inviting other languages. So it's not always in English. And we have started a big project of rebuilding the site and figuring out a way to give more ownership to the hosts of what they're doing, and to help them make a bigger like living out of doing this. And so our direction is toward more culture. So we will continue to have, you know, policy and some less cultural related content, but we have started moving earlier this year strongly towards the arts, and we have music, painting, fine arts, some film related things, photography, curation, And so I think we're on kind of good track to become the culture street on the internet, which is my big dream.
To me, hearing you describe the project as like the culture street of the internet, it's well, first off, it's a really fitting description, I think, for what you're going for. And it's sort of self-evident that that would be a good thing. And yet I would be curious to hear you describe like how you see that as a good thing. And like what, like, even though it's like, yeah, that would be a great thing to have, like, how do you conceive of that? And why is that a good thing?
So of course, Interintellect will always retain its, you know, friendly discourse origins, where any startup stance is, you know, like our fate is encoded in the beginnings in this sense. And I think for the, like, there's a DNA of every company, and that remains there. For us, it's definitely this striving for free and friendly, honest discourse and trusting people to bring that to life, whether that's through the discussion of a piece of art or science or whatever they do together. So when I say culture street, I'm again describing something that I strongly believe should and will exist through our work, but doesn't exist yet. So we live in unprecedented access when it comes to knowledge and culture on the internet, right? And we also live, or in terms of like the number of creators, we also live in an era where you can basically learn and research anything that you want with like the click of a finger. So let me phrase this again. So I'm a bit tired and becoming very hungry, so my blood sugar is right down. Sorry, I will go back to the beginning of this very convoluted sentence that I managed to put together. All right. So when I talk about culture street, I'm thinking about cultural abundance. So there are certain streets in Paris or in New York City or in London where you're flooded by cultural abundance. You literally have to like really want to avoid happening upon culture or close your eyes and ears to not have it happen to you. So that's these are these little pins in space, right? And then you have times of human life in most of our lives. For instance, when you're at college. So I don't know, you're standing on the lawn at Brown and you look around the campus, and in all of those buildings, there's some culturally amazing, intellectually enriching thing going on. And you're like, how, where should I go? It's 4 p.m. and all these things are competing for my attention. And those are the pins in time. So one is three cities in the world where actually only a few people live. And then you have these really short slots in time. And then they give you this cultural abundance in, say, college or in your hiatus years after your studies. And then the moment when you start getting it and getting good at it and getting used to it, they basically kick you out. And they are like, all right, so that was it for you. Now go and get a job. And now you can read Substack newsletters. And you're like, yeah, but I want to have a rich internal life and be intellectually active. And I'm also a human. So I'm like interested in stuff like give me literature and history and economics. You know, it doesn't have to be like postdoc level specialized thing, but like I'm an individual and I want to understand the world and history and who I am in it. And, you know, let's talk. And there's nowhere to do that. And so my dream is to make this nonsense of being time space restricted when it comes to access to cultural abundance, and just give the amazingness of humans that is so much everywhere on the internet in a curated, streamlined, beautiful way to people wherever they are. We are strongly desktop based, and that was a big decision. Like most video platforms, or Twitch, YouTube, are heavily desktop based as opposed to mobile, because we think that you should give us your undivided attention. Because the like your fellow attendees will give you undivided attention, and so you should give them as well. So it's fully equal and enjoyable. Actually, there are so few moments in a human life today where anybody, let alone a group of complete strangers on the internet, give you patient, kind, undivided attention, that I think it's in itself such a huge value. And so an interest, right? Like really engaged interest. But anybody who has, you know, a laptop, a desktop, and they can open it, can come into an Interintellect event anytime and engage in this beautiful experience. And you don't have to fly to AMMS, so in Paris or the Broadway. We want to bring it to you.
Yeah, thanks for speaking to that. I think, I was curious to hear how you would describe that, and it's nice to hear about. One question I want to ask you as well is about, I've really enjoyed reading your 11 sentence essays, and I think those are a fun little project, and I wonder if you could speak to what that's been like for you writing those. And I know in the first one as well, you wrote about, if I recall correctly, like a specific teacher that inspired you to do those originally in your studies. And I would love to hear about that teacher as well.
Oh my God. I didn't know that anybody read that article. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or essay. So I had this very interesting conversation with Nadia Ekbal in one and a half years ago. And we were talking about her hosting Interintellect salons. And she said, I will when I have an intellectual life again. And I was like, you know, you hear this sentence from like literally one of the smartest people you know, is a role model to so many people. And I was like, why does she feel this way? And then I started thinking about her, and then I literally stopped in the middle of my apartment and I was like, do I have an intellectual life? I mean, I seemingly run this company and I of course go to live events and host events, but do I have a Xena Hit style, lost in thought, individual praxis right now of intellectualism? And I realized like, no, I actually had got so lost in my practical work and in working on other people's knowledge and talent and ideas that I completely neglected it. And I was feeling really bad. Like I was feeling incomplete. And I started thinking, I didn't know what could feel this weird, like it's not a feeling of emptiness, but feeling of like, I'm not doing what I should be doing. And I remember the teacher, Ferenc Vasbányai, who was an amazing person, or is an amazing person, was an amazing teacher. He's still with us, thank God. And I started writing, and I remember the first couple of ones were just really bad because I was so I was only like writing emails at the time. So I wasn't writing poetry. And then there was a kind of heyday of the 11 sentence essays when they got really good. And now they are again kind of okay. I think there's this kind of fluctuation of the quality, or like how deep I am willing to go with what. And I'm always fighting my own inhibitions now that I'm leading a company. How am I allowed to say something in public? Will it just somehow bite me in the ass later? You know, is it bad for my company? Will my investors think that I'm unstable if I write about this thing that happened 20 years ago? And then the other, it's almost like there's this little devil in a suit on one of your, or Patagonia vest on one of your shoulders. And then there's this hippie girl with like long hair and the flowers who's like, chill out, like share your soul. You know, they're a hive mind and you have to share so that people can respond to you. And the hippie girl always wins. So I always end up like writing something super personal and like, you know, self-exposing. And then I'm taking it further now with the inter-era, which I didn't have time to write. There's a big piece that I started working on, and then my US trip kind of suspended the process, but I will definitely write it very soon. I really, like, I don't feel complete when I don't write, and I can't not write. But I do it more rarely than I think I should, which is also because it's like, so like if I write like for inter-era, then I will definitely have like one or two days in afterwards when I'm completely drained emotionally. Like, I really put all of me into these pieces, and then for a couple of days after, I'm just out of it, because it's so emotionally so moving. I don't want to say upsetting. That's not a good phrase, but it's really, it stirs me up in very unexpected ways. So my personal writing is really a returning to my roots and finding a compromise between what I want to do as a job and what I want to do for my own mind and sanity and a way to communicate with the world on my own terms.
When you had that teacher in middle school, do you remember, I was just really touched by the way you describe it. You said that it was these 11 sentence essays that made me think I might have a brain. Do you remember what that was? Like what the experience was at the time?
Yeah, I had this very long, maybe still sometimes comes back. Like, I'm really deeply worried that I'm not smart. And I'm very ready to jump on anything that might suggest this. So maybe I know 9 answers out of 10, but the 10th one I will fixate on for years after that. Oh, here's my proof, I'm dumb, you know? And I definitely did not think I was smart in any way until maybe like age 31 or something like that. I thought I was a kind of smart ass and somebody who can sound smart and pretend. But I always thought that was mainly verbal, that I have relatively good verbal skills and I can kind of like get away with things. But then I had a couple of people in my life who just thought that I was smart and worth listening to. And there was this very important moment. I think one of the things that I loved most in school was writing the 11 sentence essays. I remember the primer in which I was writing them. And I remember, like, I was so precautious that they probably sounded super old fashioned and, you know, mannered. But he was like, yeah, this is really great for like a 14-year-old, you know. And I remember instances where people would laugh at me and he would just say, no, continue. Mm-hmm. And I remember that continue, that was so urgent. And he was just a wonderful pedagogue. I'm saying was because he's retired, not because he's passed. He is a wonderful pedagogue. And I, like a lot of people in my family are educators. And I think I have a very deep respect to good ones. Like the real teacher who is a public servant and takes their life upon, you know, polishing minds, and they are not seeking rewards beyond the fact that you have the polished minds and then you go to sleep and that was your job, you know. And he was definitely one of those people. I mean, look, I'm here, this was what, when 1996, 1997, and here are we talking about it in this podcast in a completely different language, in different countries, a different continent, in a different context. And I remember Richard Dawkins in one of his good books talked about this guy, and I forget his name, I'm really sorry, I will look it up, who was his professor in Oxford when he was a student in, like, I don't know, early 60s, yeah. And, you know, this is before the publishing pressure and all those, you know, horrors that befall academics these days. And you could just be a lifelong teacher in Oxford, get a good salary, and then go home, you know. And you could just enjoy creating the next generation of the neo-Darwinist biologists in the United Kingdom. And this is what this guy did. Or there's Laszlo Detz in Hungary, who created half of the American scientific Nobel laureates, who were all Hungarians and went to the same school, and this guy was their teacher. Like Neumann, Erdős, Teller, like they all went to the same high school teacher, or were in Erdős's case, he was only competing in his like extracurricular stuff. And to me, those people, I mean, I don't have enough information, but I'm pretty sure if there was like an alumni meeting of all the people who became very successful that went to this man's classes who did the 11 Cents essays, I'm pretty sure we would be sitting, you know, around the table with people doing really interesting things around the world and having just, you know, you tell, I always say this to hosts as well, like you say the same thing to 30 people in front of you in the classroom and over again, and one day just one person hears it. You know, it's so important. You never know. And so to me, definitely this was very, very important. And I wish I had those primers. Yeah, that's kind of the story. But the 11 Cents, I think they went in a different direction, and I'm more like the good ones that I like are more like jam sessions. So it's more musical, a little bit lyrical than prose. But the original ones that we wrote when we were 13, 14 were full prose, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Out of curiosity, what was, I assume when your teacher said the word continue, it was in Hungarian. What was the Hungarian word that he said he would have said?
He would have said, probably said something like, nem baj, folytasd. Like, it's okay, or it's not a problem. Like, nambai means like, it means it's okay, but verbatim, it means it's not a problem. And foitage, or maybe he was calling me by the formal you, because this was in the Catholic school, so that would have been foitasha. So enough with the formal you. But if it's an informal you to your friend, then it's foitajd with a D at the end. Or maybe he just said them by and just like indicated with his hands to continue. But I remember which one was the person who laughed at me. And this person laughed at me twice in school. And I still, that was so horrible. And I so didn't understand why this person is laughing, that I literally have never laughed at anybody in my life in front of them as a rule. Because I never want anybody, like in a joke, yeah, you know, of course, like if the other person is on board, sure, but like meanly, never, because I still remember how that felt. And I was just like, no, I will never do this to any person. So there was that for your education as well.
Wow. Well, we've covered a lot about the Interintellect and your life, and I wonder, is there anything you'd like to say more about or talk more about?
I would love to hear, before we close, your experiences with hosting, because you did one salon. I couldn't attend. I think it was in the US evening time zone and I was in Europe. But I would love to hear what it was about, how it felt, who came.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I did one on the art of collaboration. I was working on a collaborative project and was kind of realizing around that time that I used to really hate collaboration and only did projects that I could do myself, and that I'd sort of come around over the years to collaboration and wanted to reflect on like what changed for me and how it was that I was seeking out collaborative projects. And
what changed, if you can give me a spoiler, what changed?
One of the really nice things that came out of doing that salon was, and I didn't really plan this in advance, but it sort of made sense to me afterwards to write a blog post from what I reflected on. And so there's a blog post that I wrote. If I recall, I published it the same, or very shortly after the post, if not the salon, if not the same day, it just like kind of came out. But
Republish it? Did we put it on our blog?
Sure.
Have we done it? Yeah, send it to me, because we love to republish things that are related to the salon hosting experience. So just send it to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I will. Yeah. I think what changed was, I mean, I remembered, I went back and remembered like specific bad experiences that I'd had with collaboration. And there was this one like group project that really stood out in school where it was like, it was in a class that I didn't like and on a topic I didn't like. And then it was with people I didn't like about, you know, it was just like this whole all of the constraints were things that I hadn't chosen, that were forced on me, that I did not enjoy, and other, like, the two people I was working with, like, really took advantage of me, and like I ended up doing all of the work for like three people essentially, and it was like, that's not an enjoyable experience. Of course I wouldn't enjoy it. And so, like, really inverting each of those things and giving myself autonomy of like, who will I work with, on what, on making sure it's something that I enjoy, that I'm not doing all of the work myself. And like, when you have some autonomy over what you're working on, as opposed to when you're in middle school and you don't, like that, I think, like, really choosing what projects I work on, with who, how I work on it, and then over time from iteration, like, discerning various like best practices for how to work well with people, because, you know, conflicts do arise, and you have to make decisions and stuff, and like, just knowing that you're that you have the skills to work with that as an adult. And yeah, I think that's sort of what changed, is like getting to choose what I work on, with who and how. Yeah,
that's interesting. One of the founding texts of InterIntellect, I actually wrote this on five books. I created a five books list of like five things that inspired InterIntellect at the beginning. Like now we have a lot more, like a thicker bibliography. Was this book called Interdisciplinary Conversations by the Stanford academic Mira Strober. And she basically started trying to kind of build collaborative projects in the early 70s. And at the beginning, they all fell apart. Even though she did everything well, like she was very prepared, like she had the room, the funding, all the smart people from around the world. It's kind of similar to what Google arrived at with their Project Aristotle, when they were looking at like team culture and psychological safety. And, you know, she just has these amazing stories. Like, I have the amazing Chicago school economist and the Quaker theologian, and somehow the Quaker theologian runs out crying. What happened? You know, and, or why is this person doing all the work? And the other person is like filing their nails. And so the whole book, I actually have it here somewhere. I will send you a photo. So I really recommend this book. It's a really good book on collaboration.
Cool. Yeah. It's been a joy to come around to it, because the kinds of things that I'm capable of, if I actually do work with people and enjoy it, is like much more than what I could do myself. So I've been grateful to have that shift in my own life. And it was really lovely to talk about it with people.
I love it. Maybe a good next topic would be, or my mind immediately jumps to, knowing when to collaborate. It's a frequent question we also get on my team, like, when should I have a co-host? And I know that researchers always ask, like, how many people should be writing this paper? And I think it's a really, really interesting thing to investigate, like, what are things that you should, because I think that there are things that you should be doing alone. And there are things, and then sharing it and like listening to feedback. And then there are things where you want to have multiple parents, you know, before even sharing with the world. And that would be an interesting topic, I think, for many people.
Noted. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's been really enjoyable to learn more about you and your background. And yeah, I'm so glad that you're working on InterIntellect. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun. I'm going to go back to work.
Yes.
Like the good soldier I am.
Well, and hopefully take care of your voice as well.
Oh my God. Yeah. I will. My next meeting, I will be just nodding. I will be so in agreement with everything.
Seems good.